if you look at my grade school yearbook, where like I was on a tricycle, and it said, you know, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? It says under the pediatrician, and I hear on the TV that something's going on in Parkland, Florida. That was probably the hardest day of my life. On every call, on every case, you need to get to closure. In order to get closure, your stress has to be very low prior to arrival on scene. If something is keeping me up at night, like the Hemtevi, the whole concept, I couldn't sleep. Once every couple of years, I'll say, that's it. And if I internally know, if I tell myself that's it, that's a signal to myself that I'm probably right.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Peter Hemtevi about mental health challenges at critical incidents, the story behind creating the Hemtevi app, and using psychology tools to do the EMS job better. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for all the past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Dr. Hemtevi after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMTB. Today we're joined by Dr. Peter Hemtevi. He's a pediatric emergency medical physician who's dedicated his career to providing exceptional in-hospital emergency care at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital, a leading level one trauma and tertiary care center in South Florida. He's board certified in pediatrics, pediatric emergency medicine, as well as EMS, a field he's made a significant impact in over the past 13 years. In addition to his clinical work, Dr. Hemtevi serves as the medical director for various agencies in South Florida and recently took on the role of chief medical officer for the Brevard County Fire Rescue. With a passion for innovation and a commitment to pushing the boundaries of clinical care, he's a valuable asset to the EMS profession and continues to work on the front lines. And I must add that when you retire, they tend to kick you out of the town's email system. And the one email that always seems to still come through is from the Hemtevi app. So I knew that this had to be a special interview. So welcome to the show, Dr. Hemtevi.
Thanks, David. Bonnie, great to meet you guys. Appreciate it.
It's nice to have you. So we'd love to hear about how you started as a pediatric ER doc and medical director for EMS.
Awesome. Well, it's interesting. I have, if you look at my grade school yearbook, where like I was on a tricycle in the picture, and it said, you know, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? It says under the pediatrician, and my aunt, I don't know how she found it. She gave it to me a few years ago. And so clearly there was something back when I was a kid that made me want to, you know, help others and then help other kids. And now that I have three kids of my own and I see the three different personalities, you know, one just has that same kind of essence, if you will. So I guess I would just like that growing up. And then I got into my residency at Children's of LA, big, big hospital. And I found myself, I remember no matter what rotation I was supposed to be on, I always found myself wanting to be in the emergency department or in the ICU. And then when I got into those rotations, I said, there's a helicopter and there's ambulances. So I just wanted to be in the room when the worst was happening. And I think partly it's because I love connecting with people. And in the emergency department and in EMS, you have to connect really quickly, like within a few seconds, in order for the rest of the event, if you will, to go smoothly. And part of what I still love to do today, you know, decades later, And I was just doing this morning, I have two paramedic schools I'm a medical director for. And I spent the whole morning really about the psychology of the interaction with your patient. So that's how I got started. And then in 2010, you know, so in 2005, I get to Florida. I'm working at a level one trauma center, you know, pediatric hospital, big center. And then I'm just teaching all the fire departments on my own time because I, you know, I had that love of doing that back in Pittsburgh and in LA. So I started doing that. And then 5 years into it, one of the nurses says to me, "Hey, Pete, you know, Davey Fire Rescue is looking for a medical director." And I said, "I'm a pediatric guy. They probably need an adult emergency medicine person." And she says, no. They told me to tell you, they really like you." I said, "Okay." So I applied and I was in competition with like 14 other like really good people. And it's a long story over a beer one day, but they picked me. And I really quickly had to learn everything else. So all the adult stuff and everything. And lo and behold, I kept getting asked by other departments to be their medical director. And that was a life-changing experience for me getting into EMS. Chief Julie Downey, who's now my fire chief at Davie, gave me that opportunity. And it was the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life, besides getting married.
Always have to add that one, of course.
Watch it.
I remember I received the White Hat Award at the fire department when I was a volunteer. And I got up to say my thank yous. And I said something like, "This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me." And then, you know, I was like, except besides getting married. So yeah, easy to get in trouble there. Well, we love the fact that you're, you know, kind of living in both of those worlds. And I would imagine there's a lot of stress, a lot of potential for burnout, a lot of long hours, a lot of high intensity situations. So what are your strategies for self-care and avoiding burnout?
You know, that's a very good question. I can tell you that early in anyone's career, when you're young as a paramedic, as a nurse or a physician, you feel like you could work, you know, 25 hours in a day, right? It's just that's how you come out. And then what ends up happening is that you end up maturing a little bit. You end up kind of, you know, you have a relationship, you get married, you have children, and things start to change. So early in my career, I wanted to work as many shifts as possible because I just loved, I love doing it. And then I started to recognize when my kids started to become of the age where they recognized I was actually coming home at 7 a.m. And they were waking up at 7 a.m. And they looked at me. And then when I would leave at dinner time for my shift, they would look at me. And then those looks would turn to looks of sadness. And I said to myself, you know what, I can't continue to do this. But then when you get to the hospital and you say, "I have dreams of doing this and I want to go into this," they paint you into a corner and they say, oh no, you're not. You're going to clock in, you're going to do your shifts, and you're going to make the people happy, and you're not going to screw it up. And I started to get upset then, right? Because if I wasn't in a location where, and it's a good hospital, but they didn't encourage growth. And the one thing I tell people about being a doctor, and maybe it's the same as being a nurse, which is different in the fire department, is that once you become the doctor, right, the attending physician, you basically, you're at the ceiling, right? You're at the ceiling because you're getting paid what you're going to get paid. You may get a raise here or there, but you're doing hourly work. And the only way of kind of doing more and growing more, not financially, but just growing more as a person, is to do other things. But unfortunately, they don't want you to do those things. So, David, to answer your question, that the mental struggle for me started to happen when I realized that they didn't want me to grow any further. Anytime I mentioned that I wanted to go teach here and do that, and they actually said, "No, we don't want you to do that." So to answer your question about self-care, I find myself just doing what I still do today, which is spend a lot of time with my family, taking care of what matters most, and not getting too caught up in all the hoopla of what's out there. But for me personally, if I don't continue to grow in my life and my career, that's when I start to struggle. Mm-hmm. And that's how EMS was the savior for me.
Well, kudos to you for figuring that out. And then not only figuring it out, but taking the chance to go out of your pediatric world. I can't imagine how hard that is once you're, like you said, painted into a corner of a certain thing, and then to branch out and to learn EMS and fire is no small feat, to understand the system and the people in it, what they have to do before the handoff. I really have a lot of respect for you for caring about that piece of it and wanting to know it.
Bonnie, I'll tell you that I appreciate you saying that. I think that people in pediatrics are probably best suited for EMS. Mm-hmm. And now that I mentor a lot of people out there in the world who say, hey, how did you do that? And I help them along, mm-hmm. and I encourage them, because when you're in pediatrics, you have a different way of dealing with people. And it really blends very well with the EMS community. So I would say that if anyone out there is in pediatrics, EMS is really like very closely suited to you, kind of mentally, emotionally. They want to do the right thing for people. You really, if effectively, what is EMS? It's socialized medicine. It's doing the right thing for the community without the big bill at the end of the day, right? And in pediatrics, you're also a safety net for many of the patients we see in the emergency department. By the way, they're on Medicaid, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have insurance, and we don't get upset with that as clinicians. We happily treat them and make them better so they can live another day. So there's a lot of similarities there that I think now in retrospect, I understand it better than I did as to, you know, is it just me or are there other people out there that could break into the field and actually have a very big impact.
Come on. Check it.
That might be a good segue to talk a little bit about the Parkland shootings. And we would love to hear about your role in that situation, if you wouldn't mind sharing.
Sure. So I was sitting at this desk, the same desk I'm in my office here. It's about a 15-minute drive to Stoneman Douglas, you know, straight. I'm right on the highway, so I just jump on the highway. And in the room next to me that you can't see, I have a TV. And I happened to have been having lunch, and I left the news on. Okay, now I have the radios and everything, but if you understand how the whole Parkland thing went down, how we the fire department were notified a little late, literally, I hear on the TV that something's going on in Parkland, Florida, and I didn't have my medical director shirt on. I had like a long sleeve collared shirt, you know, and kind of dress pants. If you see it on CNN, you'd see me like how I was dressed. Like, in other words, I wasn't dressed to be in the fire department that day. And I remember just grabbing my keys, grabbing my wallet and my phone, and I just made a beeline for my car. Find myself on the highway within minutes, driving at speeds that I would not encourage anyone to ever drive at, ever. But I was in a line with a whole lot of other police officers. And you know, I don't have a vehicle that's lit up or anything like that. And I just said, please, I hope they don't stop me. and I get there, and because of all the mayhem, I had to park my car like about a mile away. Mm-hmm. And I just ran into the scene. Turns out where I was running is the same exact path that this kid was running away. And, you know, I look back and I think now that thankfully he wasn't armed, but he escaped that scene before anyone even knew that he escaped. And if he was armed, he could have done a lot more damage. So I kind of look back now and I said, maybe it wasn't the smartest way that I left, that I entered that scene. But I run in. I'm very fortunate. I work with some amazing people and the Coral Springs Parkland Fire Department, from the leadership to all the personnel to all the, I mean, they're just incredible people. We had prepared for this type of event for years, because we had had a few other events, shootings, et cetera, where it didn't go so well. So we had planned, we had prepared with the police officers. We distributed IFAX. They had these kits underneath their vests with tourniquets and chest seals and hemostatic gauze, you know, for quite a while before Parkland. And our SWAT team had been educated on stop the bleed and chest seals and all that type of thing. So when all these kids were streaming out, my EMS chief, Chief Juan Cardona, he made the decision to just start loading all these injured kids onto the ambulances, no tarps, no triage tags. So he was doing all of that. They were all coming out already with chest seals and tourniquets on. So by the time I got there, all those 17 people had been, are gone already. Just that's how quickly it all happened.
Wow.
However, we're now waiting on the corner of Holmberg, which is on the corner of the, where the school is. And suddenly we hear the golf cart just kind of screeching its wheels coming out to us, and people are on the golf cart doing chest compressions, and they're screaming, "She has a pulse. She has a pulse." So I'm out there, and we approach the golf cart. It's a SWAT medic who had self-deployed. He never came to incident command. He just went into the building, and he ended up finding this girl and bringing her out. So I jump into the ambulance with my crew, and we're looking for feeling for a pulse. There's no pulse. And you have to remember, the helicopters are right over our head. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we wanted to do was bring someone in an ambulance, the ambulance not move, and then bring the person out of the ambulance. But I'm the only physician on scene. I make a calculation that I had been there now for, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, and no other patients are coming out. And luckily, another medical director, a good friend of mine, Ian Rusinoff, shows up. I said, "You're now the on-scene medical director," because he's an EMS guy. And I end up now in the back of the ambulance, traveling towards the trauma center. So obviously we do everything as far as, you know, airway, IO. And then I said, "Well, what would we do in the emergency department? We would do 2-finger thoracostomies and put chest tubes in." So I said, "Grab me a scalpel." And my medics are looking at me like, "What's this guy going to do?" And I basically did, I did the right side, massive amount of blood. Sorry, the left side, massive amount of blood. I did the right side and nothing. And we thought we were going to, you know, kind of have a chance here, because we just thought we were going to make something happen. Mm-hmm. We get to the facility, we transfer care. I go off to the back of the hospital in the back of the ER, and I'm just crying, right? Mm-hmm. They're just all coming out, and people are coming to talk to me. And literally I turned back around, I gathered myself, turned back around, I look at the room, and it's completely clean. Like, the floor is clean, everything's clean. And I'm thinking, this girl made it, right? So we ended up leaving the hospital, only to find out that, you know, they ended up realizing very quickly that we had done everything that they were going to do, and they just stopped resuscitative efforts. And I can tell you that that was probably the hardest day of my life, you know. And I had never needed therapy in my life beforehand. I worked at 2 of the top 10 children's hospitals. I'd seen the worst of the worst. But here's the problem that happened that day for me, is that 3 of the kids who died, I knew them or their families. Mm. And so when I came back to the car, my cell phone had died. I plugged it in, and all I saw were texts from my wife, because my wife graduated. She was the first graduating student from that class. She was a class president. Mm. And all she was sending me were photos of children that she knew, or that we knew, you know, later. And now I'm helpless, because I have no idea who those kids are or where they are. And now those parents are traveling to the hospital, and there's many different hospitals to travel to. Should they go to the hotel where they're telling the family members, you know, that's where your child, the people who are at the hotel, are that's where the children who have passed. So the parents didn't want to go there, right? So many emotions going on there. And we ended up doing, getting everyone into a room that night. I had a lot of anger. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of very, very many different emotions that went on that day. But I ended up needing therapy. And thanks to, you know, the folks in my department, mainly a gentleman named Chief Chris Bader, who's our chief of health and safety at Coral Springs Parkland. He looked at me, he's like, "You need help." And I said, "You're right." Because I'm the person, I never go home and talk to my wife about work. I don't relay story about patients because my wife doesn't understand that because it would just make her more anxious. So right. I was able to internalize and compartmentalize the last 20 years of my career without a problem, except for February 14th, 2018. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really needed a lot of assistance. So long story to say that day, it impacted me, but the way I look at it is that it impacted the families who lost children by 1,000 times more. And that's kind of, I always keep that as a relative marker as to, I shouldn't be feeling badly because those are the people who should be feeling really badly. And that's kind of how I process things, I guess, right or wrong.
Well, I have so many thoughts and reactions I could share, but I guess the first is thank you for being so genuine and for showing your true self and your feelings, because that's one of our biggest goals on this podcast is to show real life and to break the stigma. And just by talking and sharing that you needed help, you're already helping us achieve our mission here.
I appreciate that. I have to thank other people for that because I have now traveled the country, and we do either 4 or 8 hour seminars on Parkland, and we still do them crazily, as crazy as it sounds. And the more I do talk about it, even though I have a really hard time doing it, like you said, it helps, because selfishly, it helps me get through my own internal difficulties. Yeah.
The EMT in me resonates with you as well, just being on scenes where you've done everything under the sun and it's still their day to go. And when it's a child, it's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, just the fact that you're a true first responder, you ran to that scene. Yeah. And for that, we're grateful.
I appreciate that. You know, one of the things I committed to my community was that we were going to put whole blood on our vehicles. And part of the way that I try to heal internally is to try to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Right.
So we now have blood in Broward County. We now have blood in Palm Beach County. And over the last 3 days in Palm Beach County, we gave 7 units of blood.
Wow.
6 of those 7 people are still alive today. So part of my recovery and is understanding the gaps in healthcare today, and specifically in EMS, because where I focus my attention, it's helped me to help others and to help my community. So that's part of the slow healing process that I'm trying to go through. But I really appreciate what you've said to me. Thank you.
From my perspective, too, it is so important and so grateful to you for being so real and genuine with us and, you know, sharing that. So much, much appreciation and love and light to you for what you're doing. A little bit of a tangent from what we're talking about, and that has to do with closure, with patient care and emergency scenes. So what is closure in your world, and how can it drive better care?
This is my favorite topic. And I didn't realize what it was until I met someone named Jonathan Robbins, also in Coral Springs. When I first started in medicine, in the ER as a trainee, and then here at the hospital, I would find myself, I would see, let's say 35, 36 patients in a shift. Mm-hmm. I would keep a list of those patients, and then I put a check mark near the patients that I wanted to follow up with, right? I remember making business cards. The hospital gave me business card that didn't have any information of how to contact me. Just, you know, Peter Antevi, pediatric emergency medicine, something, and, you know, the hospital's email, hospital's URL. I went to the printer and I said, make me new cards, put my email and put my cell phone number on it. And all my colleagues thought I was crazy, man. Now, I didn't know why. I just inherently said, if I want to follow up with a patient, here's my name, my number. I have your number, and it's in the computer. Is it okay if I call you tomorrow? Oh, yeah. Absolutely, doctor, right? And I said, if you need anything from me, please give me a call. I was saying 20 years, maybe like 15 people have called me, and it's only for thank yous. They don't want – it's incredible, right? Mm-hmm. But I would call them all the check marks the next day, whether I'd be at home – or whether it be back on shift, I call them and say, hey, Mrs. Smith, this is Dr. Peter Antevi. I saw your son yesterday, Jimmy, and I want to check in and see how he's doing. And if I didn't do that, I would just kind of like not feel right, because I'm internally stressed about how that, you know, did I miss something? How's he doing? That type of thing. Then when I met Jonathan Robbins, he had a drowning case that he couldn't get out of the neighborhood. It's in Parkland. It's a gated community. And they told him to drive. He was the rookie on the truck. And he didn't know how to get out of the neighborhood. It took him 10 minutes to figure out how to get out of the exit, because he was going all these dead ends. And he kept passing the house. Don't ask. And he took the blame for that kid's death on him. Right. I'll fast forward a little bit to a couple years later. He, you know, I ended up becoming his medical director. I end up teaching him how to stay on scene for pediatric cases. And then he had two cases where he saved the kid's life back to back. So I see him at a gathering for the department. He finds me. He's like, hey, doc, I don't know if you remember, but I'm the guy who had those two saves. And I thought, like, he wants to give me a high five. He says, let me take you for a walk. And so we're in a bar, like, with the whole department, like, for a charity event. And we're both drinking, having a beer, and he starts telling me about the story from years ago where he thought it was his fault for that two-year-old's death. Mm-hmm. And he's crying and I'm crying. It wasn't a good look. but he said, now that I have those other two saves, he says, now I know how important it is to get to closure. And that was when, like, all the years of me not understanding what I was doing myself with families and emergency department, that was the most important conversation for me, because I said, that's really what he was looking for. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, he, you know, we gave him dosing. We taught him how to do high performance CPR. We gave him all the tools, but that wasn't the important part of it. He just needed to know how to get to closure. And from that moment on, that's really what I focus on with all the folks I work with, the students I work with, my medics, the 30-year medics, the 2-year medics. On every call, on every case, you need to get to closure. And, you know, if you want, we can go into it further, but there's a couple of things that we talk about with how to get to closure. And that's what I focus on today with everyone I speak to.
Well, I think it would be really beneficial for our guests to hear some of those pointers that you have, because as a trauma therapist in my office, a lot of the trauma therapy is involved with people not having closure and not knowing either what happened or what could have been different. So I think it's incredible to hear what you have to say about that.
Oswald, and remember, this is not science. This is like the brain of Peter Antevi. It could be all wrong. I'm just kind of giving you my take on it. So what I realized is, and the way I figured this out is because I come from a pediatric world, and then I'm in this big adult world all of a sudden, and I'm seeing people get the closure on the adult cardiac arrest like that. Because I was riding with them.
Yeah.
We had this guy on the tennis court, got him back to life, brought him into the emergency department. My medic, you know, my lieutenant, he's there, he's documenting, he's very proud. The wife comes around the corner. He happily goes and talks to her and the whole thing. And we went on to the next call as if nothing happened. Nothing, yeah. Right? Then we, you know, I'm on a different shift, a different ride time. We do the pediatric cardiac arrest. And it's exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. On the way to the call was massive fear. On the scene was massive fear. En route to the hospital was massive fear. We dropped the kid off at the hospital, and the parents are coming around the corner, and they run as fast as they can not to make eye contact with the family. Leaving the hospital, getting back to the station, and the thing was like a complete breakdown. That the other day we treated that guy beautifully, but today we did a horrible job. Right? That's a big horn in the back, right?
Yeah, we cue those up on.
They're giving you a shout out. That means we like the guest.
So I realized that I had to break that entire sequence down to understand where does the closure really happen. And what I learned was something that just blew my mind, was that in order to get closure, you have to have zero stress, or your stress has to be very low prior to arrival on scene. So that pre-arrival preparation for the kid. Mm. So we've implemented that so that before they get to a three-year-old drowning, they know the airway size, the epi dose, and the joules, right? Then they get on scene. Because you had that pre-arrival preparation, your heart rate is lower. You can now make eye contact with the family. You can stay on scene and work just as well as you did for the adult, right? Mm-hmm. Now there's no kind of animosity to yourself of how poorly you did. So when the family comes around the corner in the emergency department, you could tell them everything you did and how it was the best care that their child could have received. Not those words, but basically telling the parent what we did for your child, which is very important for the parent's closure. So closure part one is what I call quadrant one, which is pre-arrival, and quadrant two, on scene. If you can check those boxes off and say, we did everything we could, you can get yourself to closure as a paramedic, because you now know that when you go to sleep that night, you left nothing on the table. I mean, everything was put out, right? Then part two of closure is if you can help the family get to closure. And when you talk to families of kids who have passed away, they'll tell you that the one thing that they never get the ability to do is to hear from the people on scene of the type and quality of care that their child had. Why? Because those folks have left and gone and run away. Mm. When you can tell that family member, even with a bad outcome, we did everything we could for your child in a high performance manner. We did everything we could, and still didn't work out, that's important for that family member for a month, 6 months, a year, 10 years later. There's no doubt that their child got the best care that ever, right? So closure part one is hard in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Part two, where you have them, before they leave the emergency department, go talk to the family and just tell them what you did, not to be a chaplain or a bereavement counselor. That's closure part two. And so if I can get people to there, I mean, I'm not an expert. And that's why I don't enter into the how to talk to someone who's lost a child. Like, I don't do any of that. It's tell them what you did and give them the sense that you did it in an expert fashion. That goes a long way. And after they're done with that, I then make a phone call to the family 24 to 48 hours later as a medical director. I offer my condolences, and we offer to come to the funeral. Either I go or my EMS chief goes to the funeral. The crew hears and now knows that we are doing all that. That helps them get to closure from a whole nother level of my department cares. Hmm. And just those couple of things, and everything I told you is doesn't cost any money. It just takes a little bit of time and leadership and just doing it. Mm-hmm. That's what any department who's listening to this today, mm-hmm. they can do it. It's very simple to do.
I onboarded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
And putting my EMT hat on, I'm thinking about those calls. And you're right, you are scared. And there's a lot of fear and anxiety that goes into it because you don't see pediatrics at the same rate that you see adults. And so all of those numbers, you know, you feel nervous about it because mm-hmm. you do less of it generally, right? So do you have any specific tips or specific mm-hmm. thoughts on that piece?
I that's a whole nother podcast, but yeah. So I do. That's all a mind trick, and that's because of how we've taught pediatrics. And if you go look at any EMS protocol today, mm-hmm. except maybe for mine, there's a separate pediatric section.
Yes.
When you go to paramedic school, there's like the 3 days of pediatrics.
Yep.
I think that's the mistake, right? So I have a 137 page protocol. Mm-hmm. It's very high end, right? Probably more high end than anything you'll see in the country, but it's really thin. And everything, seizure, is adult and pediatrics on the same page. Hypoglycemia, same thing. Cardiac arrest, same thing. DSI, I mean, finger thoracostomy. There is no pediatric section. Mm-hmm. And it's so I think we need to change the way we educate. And then we have to tell our folks a 2-year-old in SVT and a 62-year-old in SVT are the same exact thing. And that takes time until you have the policies, the protocols, the education, the attaboy, the case reviews, the CQI, the data that shows that our outcomes are great. That's when you start to see the magic happen. And I know it's possible, and that's my mission now is to make that happen everywhere across the country and across the world.
That's great.
Well, it's a beautiful mission. And I wanted to tie back into when you're talking about going to that pediatric call and the pre-arrival mm-hmm. information and what your innovations are in terms of dealing with high stress mm-hmm. patient interventions and high stress emergency medical calls. Can you tell us a little bit about the story behind creating the app and what it does?
Yeah. So, you know, it's this concept of system one and system two thinking. So that there's a book I read. I remember I was on a trip with my wife. We're going on like a 1 week, we finally wanted to get away. We hadn't taken a vacation in a long time. We were flying to Tucson, Arizona, like just to get away. And I picked up this book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize winner. And so my wife is sleeping on my shoulder and she has a hard time sleeping on the plane. So I'm like trying to not move my shoulder. And I read this book and I literally had the biggest epiphany when I read this book. And I said, this is it. Like, I finally understand why pediatrics is so stressful. So I wake up my wife and she's upset with me. But so it's a very simple explanation if you read the book, but I guess I can explain it real quick. System one thinking, just for all of us medical people, if I tell you there's a 65-year-old guy who has substernal mm-hmm. chest pain, diaphoretic, mm-hmm. just by me telling you that, your brain automatically already has a diagnosis, already knows what meds to give, you already know where you're going to transport the guy, right?
Right.
That's called system one. It's just super duper fast. If we could stay in system one for everything, adults and kids, we would be flying high, right? The problem is that for kids, the part of the brain that you need or they tell you you need is system two thinking. What is system two? He describes in his book that if let's say you're running a code and I tap you on the shoulder. I say, David, Bonnie, I tap you on the shoulder. I say, what's 34 times 12 while you're running a code?
Mm-hmm.
What Kahneman says you have to do is your eyes are going to go up and to the right. So you're going to be, you have to kind of escape what's happening in front of you here. Your eyes will dilate and your brain has to go into this other form of thinking, which is like almost comes to a grinding halt. You do 34 times 10, right? So what I asked you, I did 34 times 12. So 34 times 10 is 340. And then you do 34 times 2. And then you have to add the numbers together. It's a process. Hmm. So you can just by me giving you that example, how system 2 is very different, right? Well, it turns out, what did we tell people since the 1980s in pediatrics? That you have to measure the kid after you get to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that.
Yep.
In adults, 65-year-old cardiac arrest, in route, I know everything. For the kid, 5-year-old in cardiac arrest, okay, drive 6 to 8 minutes, be stressed out of your mind because we don't know anything yet. Get to the home, take out a length-based tape,
mm-hmm.
get a weight. From the weight, multiply times the dose per kilo, get a milligram dose, divide that by the concentration to get a milliliter dose. That's all system two while the code is happening, while the parents are screaming.
Yes.
Right. So here's a trick that I learned. It took me a while to figure this one out, that as a medic, as a doctor, as soon as you hear 3-year-old cardiac arrest or 3-year-old anaphylaxis, your brain says, oh crap, system two. And as soon as the system two, like that, you know, system two is there, it has to be used. Your heart rate goes really high.
Mm-hmm.
Your palms start to sweat. Now, if your heart rate is that high and you come to the scene and you're trying to give that demeanor of, okay, I'm here to help. It turns out you cannot make eye contact with the family member. You can't speak to them. You can't do all the right things. So what do? You have that fight or flight mechanism. You grab the kid who's portable and you run. So system two is the devil here.
Mm.
So all I did with Hentevi, and unknowingly, is I said, let me just remove the system two thing. And I did it selfishly because in the emergency department, I'm at the head of the bed and I say, I need epi, bicarb, calcium, atropine, norepi, drip, normal saline, whatever. And all I would hear back is, what dose? How do we mix that? What rate, doctor? And I didn't know any of that because in Pittsburgh and in LA, there was someone doing that for me. So I created a little system because I was so embarrassed and I was horrible initially. And I created a little badge buddy that, you know, the 13579, I figured out how to know 5 different ages. And from those 5 ages, not the weights or the lengths, the ages, I can figure out all the code drugs in system one manner.
Wow.
So then when I got to EMS, I said, we got to do the same thing. And I just took the same principles that I was doing for myself, embarrassingly so. And I said, hey, let's try it in EMS. And it was like, I mean, it was like the aha moment from the gods, because in hospital, they laugh at you when you have an idea. When I came to Davey Fire, I said, Chief Downey, I think I figured something out that's really big. She said, well, we have our medical director meeting coming up. Prove it. And I remember I brought up 4 people and I gave them the tools we currently use. And I say, I want these 4 medication dosages. Not one of them, these are really smart people, not one of them got one right. And I said, now I'm going to teach you my system. And in front of my chief, they got it all within seconds. And she said to me, I'm in. Right. And I made Hentevi for the very first time at Davey Fire Rescue. And next thing you know, my phone is ringing. This agency, we heard, how did you hear? I don't know. How did we hear? Next thing you know, I'm on the road. I'm giving the talk on the 13579. I'm going to people saying, we want that. I was going to Kinko's and I was with my with my laptop. I was laminating. I was cutting the lamination. And I was making another department, custom book. And it was laughable, right? what I didn't realize all along is that EMS was the one place in healthcare that didn't have an ego. They just wanted to do better. Till today, this is 13 years after I started Hentevi, when I walk into the hospital, half the people love to see me. The other people don't even want to look at me. Why? Because those are the same people who they belittled me, and they said I'm stupid, and you can't go against the standard of care. And till today, those people have never apologized. Those people won't call me. They won't talk to me. And when I'm in the hospital, they literally will go the other way. Because the ego that you find in the hospital is significant compared to what we do in EMS. And that, in a very long way of saying it, is why I belong in EMS. That's period, end of story. So,
Well, you found your tribe.
I did.
I found my tribe.
100%.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
That's a great story about innovation and how you started kind of in the low tech. Talk about it for a minute about how Hantevi is delivered these days. It's not Kinko's laminated cards, is it?
Although I still have some of those laying around. This was when the iPhone was kind of coming in and people were having apps and everything. And what happened was we would print these guides, and then a year later, we make one medication change. So we got to reprint all the guides.
Yeah.
And someone said to me, hey, like, there's these apps. Why don't you go make an app? So we found another printer and down in Miami. He's giving us a little cheaper deal. And I said, hey, you guys do apps? He's like, yeah, we do apps for Burger King and McDonald's. I said, okay. I said, can you help me? He's like, sure. So we go into this room down in Miami, just me and him. And he had walls that you can kind of write on, right? Like, it wasn't even a chalkboard. And this guy is like, by the end of this like 6-hour session, there was things everywhere. And I'm like, this is never going to happen. Anyway, make a long story short, the guy builds me an app within like 3-4 months. And he was all excited. He's like, it's launch day. And he's used to launch day, meaning like tens of thousands of users are going to get on the platform. A week goes by. The only user is me. Another month goes by. He calls me up. He's like, is everything okay? I said, what do you mean? He's like, no one's using the app. I said, yeah, I got to go convince someone to use it. So we started one at a time. It was literally one, two, another three people. And literally, we kind of started adding features. And then once we connected the app into the electronic medical record, so ESO, Image Trend, now we're with like 6 or 7 of them. And then we added CPR Assist, which is a metronome that has all these things in it. And then we added protocols and checklists last year. And that's when it was like the tsunami. Hmm. Our phones, like literally it was, and I was like, wait a minute. We built a beautiful app for pediatric medication dosing. And we had a lot of people using it. And then we added protocols and checklists. And that's the thing that made those people on the fence jump up. So I'm very, very blessed to say that we have, over 2,500 cities. Wow. We have three states that we've officially said that are using us, but we have a couple more we haven't announced yet. Hmm. But the state purchased Hantevi for every agency in the system.
Wow.
That's great. We have 40 people at the company. And my wife gets all the credit. She's the CEO, and I become like, just a guy who goes, shakes hands and kisses babies. And that's pretty much it.
Well, that's such an inspiring story too, though. It's like, how do you take something that you stumble upon that's really just so smart in your profession, and then how do you get it to other people? And It's just a good story of how anybody could probably do that if they really wanted to, right? To figure something out, but you stumbled on it and there you go.
And I get a lot of people, I mentor a lot of people who are, you know, people call me, hey, how did you start your company and everything? So there are people out there in EMS that I'm really coaching.
It's great.
But what I tell them is that the first 10 years is the most difficult, because if you're trying to change the standard of care in healthcare, it is like literally impossible. And it takes 10 years for you to prove the concept, do the, you know, get the data, get customers, get feedback, convince the other people. And then, and so literally for us at the 10 year mark for us is when things all of a sudden just went haywire.
Right.
Even though I'm the same person I was back then, it's the same concepts as it was back then. Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
Right. Except the hearts and minds of the people out there like us who don't want to modify what we do on a day-to-day basis because it's what we've always done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it takes an amazing amount of insight, I think, to recognize that there is something that can be changed for the better and to figure out how to do it. And, you know, kudos for having done that. And obviously it's having a huge impact and changing people's lives. So, quite an amazing story.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Listen, the whole blood thing is the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm screaming from the mountaintop telling people that whole blood is like the most important thing that's happened in trauma care in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
I get people who look at me, but I know because I've seen the movie before, is that all those people are waiting for is for some social proof.
Mm.
They want to see that the other people are using it, that there's no hiccups yet, that there's no potholes. So people in healthcare inherently wait a little longer and a little longer and let the next chief do it or let the next doctor do it. I'm on the left side of the bell curve where I've learned about myself one specific thing, because I'm not good at a lot of things, okay? But what I am good at is that if something is keeping me up at night, like the Hentevi, the whole concept, I couldn't sleep. I told my wife, we have to fix it. Whole blood is another thing. Stroke care. We put up a whole stroke registry for the state of Florida after my grandfather passed away, and they did a horrible job. And I said, I have to fix the way stroke is handled here. And it took us a decade to do it, but we have this incredible stroke registry. And all of those things, every single one of them, for years, people say no, 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 no. But what I learned about myself is that if I cannot sleep and it doesn't happen to me every day, but like once every couple of years, I'll say, that's it. And if I internally know, if I tell myself that's it, that's a signal to myself that I'm probably right. So I've had to learn to trust my own intuition, which is probably the one thing that I can rely on today, because I'm not a good business person. Horrible. I hate money. I hate the thought of money. I'm not a good business person. We grew up poor. So for me, it's just, I just know who I am now that I'm 50. I've gone through these iterations much better than I ever have. And that's made me a better, just a better person and a better leader in this field.
I know that we're coming to a close soon, but I don't want to end without knowing what MCI Mondays are, because it sounds pretty exciting.
Listen, there are a lot of things I cannot take credit for. This is one of them. I have an incredible, so here in Davie, Florida, there are a lot of things that have happened on the back of a napkin. One of those things is years before Parkland, I'm sitting with my fire chief, Julie Downey. She's my EMS chief back then.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, hey, did you know that before you became medical director, we passed a law in Davie that forced all these big businesses and buildings of certain sizes to have an AED? I said, oh, that's amazing. And I said, as a joke, I said, isn't it funny how we have these tourniquets and all this stop the bleed? It wasn't even called stop the bleed back then. I said, we should probably put them in there too, right? And she says, we can do that. And I said, we can? So she goes through, we changed the ordinance. We, meaning she, changes the ordinance. And we were the first town in this country to do that. And we got invited to the White House. It was this whole big thing. It was pretty cool. so she's like the MCI guru. And so she comes up with MCI Mondays, which is basically every year for a span of like 3 months. It's not all year. We have a church that on Monday, they give us the entire church. We have connected with our police officers in a way that we've connected them so closely that when you come to this MCI drill, when you look at my firefighters, they look like cops because they got all the ballistics. Mm-hmm. And you look at the police officers, they look like medics because they're putting the chest seals and putting the tourniquets on. So MCI Monday has caused us to almost lead to role reversal such that the cops don't think that they're cops anymore and the paramedics don't think that they're paramedics anymore. Mm-hmm. They understand that they're one team. And that's what happened in Parkland. And God forbid it ever happens in Davie because my kids go to school all around in here. When I go and speak, I tell people that you can't see the police department, let's say for cardiac arrest, for shootings, for whatever. They are just the same as we are. Right. And we depend on them. So MCI Mondays is just that, from 5 to 8 o'clock every Monday. And you're more than welcome once we start them back up again. And we'll give you the gear. And we'll go into the church and we'll have some fun.
David and I will fly down for a little field trip action.
Anytime.
We'd like sounds to put like our uniform back on again, right, David?
Absolutely. Sounds like a great field trip. Yeah. Well, Dr. Antevi, thank you so much for sharing all this and your story, or your multiple stories, which are all quite amazing. Yeah. How can people find you out there in the world of the internet or social media?
Yeah, so I mainly linger around on LinkedIn and on Twitter. I answer 100% of the people who reach out to me, and I love connecting with people. So, you know, you can just go to Twitter and just message me or whatever. You could also email me directly at my email, which is peter@handtevi, not Antevi, but handtevi.com. Mm-hmm. What I try to do is like we have a Facebook, I don't have a personal Facebook account, but we have a Handtevi account. And three times a week, I take three articles, EMS related, adult and pediatrics, and I'll summarize them in less than 2,000 characters, and then I'll link the article. So what I do, you know, I don't do this that often, which is a whole, which I really appreciate. I love talking about it, but what I love to do is just give content. And whether people use Handtevi or not, I just want them to be better at what they do. Right. And my way of giving back and to give to people is to just, so if you look on YouTube, I have three YouTube channels. Handtevi is one. Real Emergency is another, where we have live body cam and we describe an entire case. It's incredible. Hmm. Yeah, I've done 13 episodes. And then Florida NAEMSP, which I'm the chapter president of, We have about 103 30-minute webinars with people who have written papers. I interview them every Tuesday at 3 p.m. And then I put that up on YouTube. So it's everything is 100,000% EMS, and it's all kind of cutting edge, not the old stuff. It's kind of the stuff that we may be doing in a year or two from now.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we'll put all those links up there. Yeah. And given how active you are and busy out there, doing all this amazing work, we deeply appreciate your spending the time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Remember to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, UPSradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.